Good morning. Welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on February 6, 2024. The time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PB Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. To my right is Tony Olson, our Vice President. To my left is Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary. John Harlow, our CEO General Manager. Colin Willenbrock, our General Counsel. And Melissa Collins, our Commission Executive Services Director, at the table to my dear right. In front of me is Jenny Rich, our Deputy Clerk of the Board. Morgan Stolzner, to the far right, Deputy Clerk of the Board. And to my near left is Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices. This session is for the Board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with the staff. So first on our agenda is item one, our CEO General Manager briefing and studying session. And our General Manager, John Harlow, will facilitate. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. First up is our media update from Aaron Sweeney, and Aaron is joining us virtually. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Commissioners. Hello from the sky, Aaron Sweeney, PR and media specialist. Apologies for being virtual, but I seem to have come down with something over the last 24 hours. So why don't we just jump right into it? If you have questions, please feel free to just interrupt me. I'll take some pauses just so you guys can break in. First up, we had some cold weather conservation messaging go out earlier this month in the face of the significant cold snap that we saw coming in the second weekend of January. We put out a press release, did some radio interviews, posted information to our website, posted information to our social media. The messaging really was around conservation and protecting pipes. I think in light of how dramatic the situation was, we maybe could have done a bit more. So we're kind of taking a look at everything and currently working up some videos and kind of some more information that can explain a situation like we went through, talk about energy markets, talk about how, you know, have a little bit more of a call to action from our customers of why we want them to conserve more than just conserving for, you know, saving money or saving energy, but conserving to help reduce strain on the grid. It really seems to help customers when they can understand why we're asking them to conserve in these situations. So Krista's working on a video, like I said, that maybe we'll get to the heart of that. Along with some the cold weather messaging we had some storm coverage from media. This storm season has been rather mild, you know, knock on wood, but we've had a few outages, especially during that ice and snowstorm out east. We had some pretty challenging outages and had some coverage from Como, Cairo, did some interviews for that. The one kind of ironic story was the Herald's newsroom actually lost power, so they called us and wanted to know maybe when they would have power. So we were able to give them some information on that. And also they did a story kind of talking about the outage that was affecting downtown Everett. Some other items over the last month, Snohomish Tribune reported on our interest in First Air Field out in Monroe. I worked with Brenda White, Mark Fleury, and Doug Wilson to get them some info on the story. We're still early in the process on that, but I think it was good to show kind of the benefits that that property would have for the PUD. And I think the story turned out pretty well. The Herald also reported on the community solar bill that you guys were briefed on last commission meeting. Worked closely with Ryan Collins in government relations on getting the reporter some information. It looks like you'll be hearing more about that bill later this morning, so I'll try not to spoil the surprise. Couple of miscellaneous mentions. Clearing Up did a fairly comprehensive piece on the cold snap and the generation and transmission issues many of the Northwest utilities experienced, including us. And we were mentioned in that story. And we were able to give kind of a shout out and kudos to our power trading desk for all the work they did through that event. And then we were also mentioned in the Port of Everett story on working closely with the port as they electrify and go through that process. Next up for publications in the February Wire, we focused on the Snow Smart grant and how we're building a stronger grid of tomorrow. We also have some information on the Energy Block Party coming up. and our meter readers. I know you guys were able to visit with the meter readers earlier in January and talk about how the great work they're doing. So we gave them a shout out on the wire and really kind of shined a light on them. And then also information on Run for Warmth, a little more information on our historical Celebrating 75, talking about the 1950s, and Power Talks. And then finally, I wanted to highlight this postcard that's going to be going out soon to all customers that have received a new ConnectUp meter. We realize that it's not really intuitive for our customers to go check out their interval data on MySnowPud. So we wanted to send them something that was kind of a reminder for them to go do that. And it also walks them through the process of how they can change their MySnowPud to view interval data. So if you have a ConnectUp meter, you'll be receiving this postcard soon. And then we'll be sending this postcard out every month in a rolling format. So if you've gotten your meter 6 to 8 weeks after you receive that meter, you'll receive a postcard like this, kind of pointing you to MySnowPud and pointing you to how to access that interval data. That QR code actually sends you to a website where we have a video as well that Krista made. So it also walks them through in a very short video format, helps them understand interval data, why it's important for them, and why it's a big benefit. And that's all from me.
Any questions? I don't know. I think I might have a comment. Postcards. We're only sending one to each customer that has one of these, that has a meter installed, correct?
Correct. Yeah, so once you get your meter, about 6 to 8 weeks later, you should receive this postcard.
Should there be another cycle, a stage cycle, to send out another one? Because postcards, people will lose them in their mail, or it takes more than one time to bring something to a customer's attention. Or to my attention. Has anything given to that?
Yeah, and we can check the data on this and see. So we can see in MySnowPud how folks are reacting to this postcard. And if we're seeing that it's maybe not getting the uptick we want, we can have maybe a touch base with these customers in a different way and engage with them and maybe point them again to MySnowPud and checking out the data.
Well, I will first ask my fellow commissioners if they have any interest. If they don't have any interest in this at all, I don't want staff to be going out and doing any work that's unnecessary.
Well, I have an interest in just general about when people get their meter, if they're using MySnowPud. So I think that lines
if
up.
If what?
If they're using MySnowPud after they get their meter. So whether it's because of this or because of social media, I would be interested in others.
Well, I think that's a great point, Commissioner Olson. And communication is so important. And I know that a number of customers would like to know more detail about how to opt out if they want to opt out, and how that's going to be done. And I haven't seen that in the media at all, other than mentioning that it will be possible. So I just think it would be more just to do that.
Well, to clarify, my comment was around getting the information, the necessary information on the use of these meters and hitting them more than once.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And we will, this is an initial and first
attempt,
attempt or paying our customers to just remind the advantages of having the smart meter installed, what they can use and what they can do with that. Or how they can use it. And we'll figure out the right way to continue those messages, because we want the greatest amount of uptake and really utilization of those AMI meters by our customers. And when we can start deploying, time of day rates and EV charging rates and all those kind of things, I mean, that's when we'll really start to engage customers.
Yeah, you said all the other opportunities, and that is good and more cost effective.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, we want the greatest uptick of customers actually using it for their own energy efficiency, which helps us saving money. It's an important part of the deployment of the meters.
And regarding communications, I just think timeliness is essential.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Aaron, I have another question. So the Clearing Out article was great that we helped. Have we thought about whether to write an op-ed or start helping or educating our customers on what happened during that cold snap?
Yeah, I was talking to Lisa about that the other day, that, yeah, I think an op-ed would be really good just to kind of explain to our customers, you know, what we went through, you know, why the energy markets are changing, and what customers can do to help. And like you said, it gets to that heart of what the crux of the problem is. And so I think that's something that I've been thinking about. And I think putting some together on paper would be a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's another way. There's been a lot of thought around that. And not to get too far off on a tangent, but it's really a lot of the policy decisions that are being made. And I don't think folks realize, certainly in Washington State, really the region or the West wide, the impacts that those policy decisions are already starting to have and will continue to have. From a cost perspective, from a reliability perspective. So we want to frame up the op-ed and not only in that venue, but other venues start to have a little louder voice in that regard. And you probably saw the article, Clark, on Clark PUD, who had a significant rate increase.
Yes.
14%. You look at the reasons, they're all same things that we're going through, same thing that the region is going through. And it's costing our ratepayers lots of money. Mm-hmm. It's a situation where we are tearing down the bridge before we have a new bridge built, so to speak.
Well, I also would like our customers to understand that, you know, the region is getting close to not having enough power. It's not just about money, it's just about.
Yeah, it's both. It's reliability and cost. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Great, thank you. Any other questions, Commissioner?
No.
Thank you, Aaron. Or Bob, hope you get feeling better.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Aaron. All right, next up, you have the legislative packet in, or legislative update in your packet, and we have Kim and team here, Kim Johnston and team here. So, is there any questions?
On House Bill 1589 and Senate Bill 5562, ESA decarbonization.
How did I get that far?
It was one of these, I think that was one that we're kind of holding back on this. Is that true?
Hi, yeah, so this is Ryan Collins, State Government Relations and External Affairs Specialist 3. Thanks for the question, commissioners. So I understand there's two questions there. The first is, how did this get so far? This is a bill that carries over from last year and was already on the House floor, given its the work that was done in the previous session. So it was voted off the House floor a couple weeks ago and then just had a hearing in the Senate Policy Committee. So there's already been a lot of work on it. And so that's kind of the reason why it's been, it's so far along in the process. To the second question, we are still reviewing it. There has been lots of changes introduced, a new one just this week. And so we're continuing to have the team kind of look at the impacts and just the overall scope of how this would impact SNOPUD's operations.
Would you be able to say a little more about the impacts?
Yes, and sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just wondering what, from your team's point of view, what are you most concerned about regarding impacts?
Yes, so we are, as I mentioned, we are continuing to review this. I think the area of interest for a lot of our folks is specifically how, were this to become law, PSE gas customers in Snohomish electric utility service area, how those customers would be transitioned and how quickly, I think, are the kind of the two big questions that we have that are still outstanding in terms of kind of what that would do for us. But those are kind of the two areas that we're most focused on.
Okay, thank you very much, Ryan.
No problem.
Any other questions, Ryan?
No. Oh, I do have one.
Okay.
That I wanted to ask about.
All right.
SHB 2156 and Senate Bill 6256 requiring all Washington solar installers to be licensed as electrical contractors. Is that a new requirement? It seems, I guess a lot of them are, but is that a new requirement, or is that something that, can you speak to that?
Yes, thanks, Commissioner. That's actually a great question, and off the top of my head, I am not entirely sure that they are required to be certified electricians. I'll also look over at Miriam Daca, our contract lobbyist, if she has any insight into that as well. I believe that LNI has certain requirements for installers of certain types of project sizes, but I'm not entirely sure if this is a new requirement or not, but I can get back to you on that.
Well, it says they have to be licensed, and that's kind of a big step for some people who are electricians. There are so many different levels, as I understand it, of being licensed, certified, whatever. So I hope that doesn't reduce the number of qualified people who would be allowed to do solar installations. Anyway, when I read that, I thought, is that going to reduce the number? Is that going to greatly affect the number of people who are perhaps already qualified, but they might not have their license or something? Maybe it's a good thing.
So I don't want to speak on their behalf, I know the solar installers of Washington did sign in support and testify on the most recent bill, and they were very keyed in on this provision.
Okay, well, that says it speaks well for the bill.
Yes, okay. Of course.
Any other questions on the bill's questions?
No. I have
another one. Oh, you have another one, okay. You have no more, you said?
No more.
Okay, thank you. Ryan, I don't have any. I'm glad the water system one died, and I do like the new format and how they get grayed out.
Yes.
So, fade to gray. Thank you.
Gray.
Great.
All right, thank you, Ryan. Next up is property for purchase for a future 115 kV Bring Bus in Maroon Bars. Good morning, Maroon.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. Yeah, I'm Maureen Barnes, the Manager of Real Estate Services, and I actually have Jeff Collin here with me, who is the engineer with substations. And what we're going to talk about this morning is the potential purchase of a 10-acre site for a 115 kilovolt ring bus. So the purpose of the presentation is to inform the board of the proposed fee purchase of 10 acres located at 8520 180th Street Southeast in Snohomish. I want to outline the primary terms of the transaction and let you know that also we will be back at the February 20th commission meeting for consideration within a resolution for consideration of this.
I just want to let you know that I did a lot of deep research into what buses are. There's all the kinds of buses.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and this one is not the most serviceable, but it's a good one. It's a good amount, right? Well, 115 kilovolt.
Yes. Could you clarify what you mean by serviceable?
Are you talking to my friend?
Sure.
Yes. Well, okay. So there are all these different kinds of buses, and I didn't take notes on that. But I spent a lot of time on the internet trying to understand what buses are all about. So is the bus the bar that they all tap into?
Correct. The bus is kind of, let me introduce myself. I'm Jeff Cullen with Substation Engineering. I'm actually a civil engineer. So I will address the bus.
You don't have to talk. You don't have to do a lecture on buses.
But the bus is a general term for, it looks like a pipe that everything connects to within a substation.
Yeah.
And so the ring bus is basically built in a loop, and then we can branch circuits off of that. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I just want to thank you for pushing me to learn more about buses.
So we, who advances the slides? Can we do this?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go ahead on. So we've had a need for a ring bus in the Turner's Corner Malpe area in our capital plans for a long time. We started in substation engineering and real estate, started looking way back in 2015. And so we've been looking for about 8 years to find a suitable site. And the area we're looking in is, it's basically a watershed area. There's a lot of wetlands, a lot of topography changes, a lot of streams and buffers to deal with. And most recently, we found this 10-acre site, and it meets our needs. It'll be a functional site for us. It's near our existing Clearview substation, and it's near our transmission lines on Highway 9. So it gives us a kind of a nearby opportunity to extend those lines to the new site. And then it gives us options to go east and south to our future Paradise substation, which is near Echo Lake. So we already have the property for that one. But basically, we need the site. There's two dependencies. We need the ring bus for the near-term project, which is the Echo Lake substation, the Paradise substation. And that's to be energized in 2028. And then on the long-term front, we need this site so that we can extend our transmission loop eventually to the Sky Valley switching station in Monroe. Any questions on this slide?
Jeff, is it common for a ring bus to not be installed at a substation, but somewhere in between substations? Does it matter?
I'll answer that by reversing it in some ways. Many utilities have standalone ring buses. We, in many cases now, have combined where we have a ring bus and we add a distribution bank at the ring bus. So we're a little bit unique in that regard. I can't speak to the electrical question as much. I don't know if
that's
here wants to move in on that.
Thank you.
This image, the red lines basically show our existing transmission lines in our existing substations. The proposed site is the green rectangle in the kind of upper middle there. And then our future Paradise substation property is the green in the lower right. And that's the property we already have. And so what we envision is this property to be developed. Basically, there'd be two steps to the overall project. We build the ring bus first. That would get us our transmission down to the Paradise, the future substation in the southeast. And then eventually, we would add some distribution banks as capacity demands. And then also the long-term plan for the lines. Any questions on this slide before we move on? There is a house, unfortunately, on the property, but it's vacant. The owner has passed away. And we were able to be one of the first in line to make an offer on the property. We have done the due diligence on the property. We had consultant teams go down and look. In this area, one of the main things is wetlands. And out of the 10 acres, roughly about half of it is covered in wetlands. But the remaining 5 acres gives us the site we need and the space we need to install the required buffers and setbacks and landscaping buffers. We've looked for environmental contamination and found none. We looked for geotechnical hurdles. And basically, no red flags were raised. And we have met, I did meet with the county, had a pre-application meeting just to discuss the possibility of conditional use permit for this area, the site. And there were no red flags raised there either. So we think this is a pretty good site for this. And I'm going to turn it back over to Maureen.
Thanks, Jeff. So when we're looking at the proposed site, as we said, it's located at 8520 180th Street, Southeast Nahomish. And as Jeff touched on, it is 10 acres and it does include a 3,000 approximate square foot home, which was built in 1997. Purchase and sale agreement was signed November 28th, and it included a 60-day due diligence period and then an additional 30 days to close. So we're looking at closing at the end of February if everything goes through. We paid a $50,000 earnest money, and it will be credited toward the purchase price of $1,950,000. And as Jeff said, it's not ideal to have a house. We were hoping and looked into many different ways that we could carve out an area and resell it. Unfortunately, in that area, it's a 5-acre minimum. So that doesn't seem to be something that would work, but we're also looking into different ways that it can be the most environmentally friendly and the least impact on that. Our next steps are going to consist of returning on February 20th with a resolution for commission to vote on that would allow us to complete the purchase for the property. Substation engineering, system planning and protection, real estate all recommend that we purchase this 10-acre site in 2024 in order to secure it while we continue with preliminary engineering and planning. The appraisal was done, and I will say the appraisal came in a little bit lower than what we had originally offered, and luckily the seller worked with us and then did drop the price down. And that's all I've got. Any questions?
Questions?
I just asked, we're going to have a lot more rain. Is there a possibility that we would have future wetlands areas in that? Are we going to be okay pretty much long term?
I believe so, but I'm going to turn that over to Jeff.
It's a good question. The wetlands in general follow the topography, and the site has the 5 acres where we intend to build is kind of the higher spot on the site. The wetlands are on the lower north side of the site. So we don't see that as a possible, as an issue with more wetlands.
Well, I know that our engineers and our workmen have been able to do amazing things even in wet areas. So I hope we don't run into any problems with what they're having in California right now.
Good question. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad.
Another question? Rules?
No.
My question or concern is, it's got a modest house on it that has to
modest
be of some value, right? 3,000 acres, it's pretty bigger than my house. And I'm curious if there's not other sites in the area that make more sense, as far as it just seems a shame to tear down a house.
Yeah, and quite honestly, I completely agree with you, and it's not what our general choice would be. But not only that, there's also a Williams Pipeline easement that goes through, and luckily on this parcel, it kind of seemed to hit everything for us, which is outside of where that easement actually goes. And then again, as Jeff mentioned, a lot of wetlands.
Okay. And no concerns with the easement to get our line in and out of the site?
No, we already have, we energized the site right now.
Okay.
So no, we don't see any.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Any follow-up questions, commissioners?
Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you, Jeff. Next up is 2024 budget general electric revenue adjustment, and Christina Einweber and Peter Oppenhauer. Morning, Peter.
Great, good morning. Peter Nauenhauer, Senior Manager of Rates Economics and Energy and Energy Risk Management. I'm also joined in this presentation with Christina Leinweber, our rates expert in the department. And so we're going to be tag teaming this presentation. So happy to talk to you about our general electric revenue adjustment for this year. Our purpose and agenda here is we're going to present our results of our general electric rate adjustment following our budget. And this is for information and consideration at this time. We're going to have a public hearing in a couple of weeks, and the board will be asked to approve that in March 5th. As far as our agenda, we're going to talk a little bit about the backgrounds and recent events, and then get into our rate design approach, the proposed adjustments that would be effective in April 1st, and then look at some comparisons for us versus other utilities in the area, especially based on recent events, and then talk next steps. Most of this is going to be presented by Christina, so I'm just going to be kind of getting you started here. So just a quick review. I know the Commission's seen and heard this information previously, but just wanted to acknowledge kind of what's been happening is that we've had some key pressures to our 2024 budget. That is kind of across the board. Supply chain inflation has impacted us. We've seen high market prices, with tight markets, high gas prices. We've had a bad water year in 2023, and then we've had some cold event coupled with low water and in January. And so given all this, we're aiming to a 5.8% revenue adjustment for 2024 on average. And we can say that from this point forward, looking at our budgets, that's a 3.5% adjustment in 2025, and then followed by 2% adjustments in 26 and 27 are what we expect, subject to changing costs and revenue pressures, of course. And so this general revenue adjustment, we think, will ensure that the PUD recovers sufficient revenues for our expected costs and puts our reserves on a sound trajectory. As an overall process, that's what I can describe here. We look at, first of all, the question is how big is the entire pie that we need? This is the revenue requirement, so we use that budget to determine that overall amount after we estimate all our expenses. Then we use what's called a cost of service analysis, or COSA. Often we might accidentally use that acronym here and there. To kind of analyze the projected costs and then in usage patterns, and then come back and ask the question, how much revenue is required by each one of our classes? So we think of this as the slice in the pie, how big that needs to be. And finally, we ask the question, okay, well, how do we collect that revenue from each class using the rate design that's part of that class? What are the specific charges, either in terms of per month, per kWh, or per kW, in order to actually collect that amount that we intend to collect? In other words, how should someone eat a slice of the pie? And just a quick overview of our rate classes, we're going to be talking about kind of Schedule 7, Schedule 20, and so forth. And so it's worthwhile to just kind of briefly cover these just for everyone's refresh of them. Our Schedule 7 is a residential class, by far the largest class in terms of energy use over a year. Our single family, multifamilies are all under this rate class. Our Schedule 20 is our general medium service, these grocery stores, hotels, light industry. And these customers have peaks that are over 100 kW. Schedule 23 is our special continuous class. These are telecom providers, utility providers. This is special attachments. This is actually our second largest class within these that we show here. Time of use, it has a single customer on it. It's manufacturing. This was our legacy time of use rate. And compared to the others, this is actually the smallest class. Our general small service is Schedule 25. This is like convenience stores, banks, and churches. These are commercial customers which have a peak under 100 kW. And then, of course, Schedule 36 is our large primary customers. These are very large peaks, six of these customers. And finally, our lighting schedules 1, 3, 4, and 5, which are street and traffic lighting, municipalities and neighborhoods. All right, we're going to go ahead and go into the actual proposal results. If there's a question, I can take that now.
Yes. In what category would we find hospitals? What rate class?
Yeah, generally 20 and 25, but 20.
Yeah, 20. 20, okay. And what about shopping malls?
20, yeah, 20.
And what about Boeing as a manufacturer?
Schedule 36.
24?
36. Boeing, I think, has several accounts. I think they've got some on 20 and some on 36, primarily 36.
The water.
Yeah, we see that. Okay. I think, what about the cannabis users?
It'll be mixed, but you could probably guess 20 or 25.
Okay, thank you.
Schools.
Schools, 20, generally 20.
Yeah, 20, okay.
Any other questions before we continue?
Thank you.
Okay, at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Christine. I'll be here for any other questions for me.
So now we're going to step here into the second part of the cost of service. We've got our overall revenue that we need, that big 5.8, but we need to divide it between the customer classes and decide what rate impact each particular customer class should have. There's a very set way that utilities do this. It's called a cost of service analysis, and it has three main steps. So the first is called functionalization. So each of those costs that we identify in our budget and our future plans is divided based on what it does for the utility. So is it a generation thing? Is it a transmission thing? That kind of stuff. And then we say, well, now based on what activity the utility is functioning, what is driving that cost? Because the primary question of cost of service is, who is causing that cost? And the primary legal principle is that the person who caused the cost should pay the cost. And so we say, okay, is it their peak usage? Is it their overall usage? Is it just the fixed amount customer? And then the final step, the allocation step, we actually look at the class characteristics and say, okay, based on what this is and what's driving it, which class should that be? And as a reminder, the sort of levers and classes that we have to raise that revenue are primarily the residential class. That's our overwhelming amount. So it's going to impact the residential class sort of by default, anything that we do, because it's just such a huge amount of our revenue. So here is the eye chart here. We got it down to just one eye chart for the cost of service results here. And if you remember last year's eye chart, it shouldn't be too much of a surprise because it's very similar, but I'll walk you through the table here. So the first line here is the revenue that we would expect to get over the next year if we kept our current rate. And then the second line is once we've put all those costs through the three phases of COSA that I just described, what in this theoretical cost causation world should each of those customers be paying? And then you can see this nice green line shows those differences as a percentage. And we can see that of the larger classes, of course, the smaller classes are so small that any tiny change makes a giant percent difference. But for the larger classes, we see particularly the residential and the large primary, the lighting having some differences there. And also for the general classes, you know, having maybe even a little more than their costs currently. And this is consistent with our last cost of service. So this was not a surprise when it came out. And this is something that we planned to slowly work on as we continue, because the goal is always to be moving towards cost of service. But we have other factors that we want to consider to achieve cost of service in a balanced way that doesn't shock the customer classes. So as moving towards that goal, and since we do have a higher rate increase this year, the recommendation that we settled on is here in the next three lines, which is to actually keep the residential class here at the system average, and then make some adjustments through the rest of the classes to recover the needed revenues to get that overall system average that we need. Does that make sense? Do we have any questions now?
Questions?
Yes. What you just said, that means that one class might subsidize another class?
Yes.
Yes, that's something we should be doing.
That's,
Who should I look at?
I can take
a question. Yeah, we've had a lot of discussion. We've gotten here over a number of years, and not having a lot of history on why the decisions were made, on how we allocated our cost historically, and knowing where we want to go, which is to get back on par, we want to figure out the right philosophy and right way to do that effectively. Because you can see the significant increase, if we did it all at once, but a significant impact it would have if we tried to do it all at once.
So this was a policy decision in terms of subsidizing one class over another. This was an internal policy decision, or is there some legal standing for that? There's nothing in there.
Yeah,
So yes, we had a bunch of decisions, and we had many options on the menu, from a more aggressive way and a less aggressive way. And we hoped that this would be a slow and balanced way of getting there. We're hoping that in the future, when we project smaller rate increases, we can maybe take bigger steps in the classes to reduce the subsidization.
And I understand that, but you're not answering my basic question.
Do you want to answer it from a legal perspective?
Is there anything in the RCWs?
Short answer is no. So the way this has been analyzed, and as has been noted, it's more of an art than a science, you know, cost of service analysis. And then when we allocate and apportion, as long as we have a process and we've identified those costs and fairly apportion them amongst rate classes, we cannot discriminate against any particular rate class. It's really the legal standard. It has to be non-discriminatory rate. So in this case, what the staff is presenting is a plan for fairly apportioning allocating costs, taking into consideration the impacts it may be had on customers. So you see, for example, residential recommendation will be 10% roughly. We're going to apportion those costs and recover those costs over time, which we're also going to discuss the use of reserve funds and how we'll meet some of our revenue requirements that way over time. Most of the percentages, if you look, are all less than what the cost of service adjustment would state is needed.
Yeah.
Right.
So so that is something that in my head I've just over the years misunderstood. In terms of it's another measure which is discriminating.
As long as the costs are recovered fairly and apportioned in a non-discriminatory manner. There's always going to be some amount of subsidization in the way that we allocate those costs. But in this particular instance, as long as it's evaluated and fairly and non-discriminatorily apportioned, we're on sound legal footing.
So I think, Commissioner, if I can help, the discrimination standard, of course, it's a balance. And it's always in the eyes of the beholder. But we're not purposefully assigning costs to a class because we don't like the activities that they're doing. So we can't say, oh, we think cannabis is bad, so we're going to make them have a high rate. That would be the kind of thing that they want to avoid when we're talking about discrimination. We're not looking at what they're doing or who owns the businesses or something like that. We're saying what we're looking at is your measurable objective electrical patterns and the overall financial strength of the utility and the health of the utility and how we can sustainably keep those revenues coming in a way that doesn't cause too much harm to anybody. So that's as opposed to saying, we don't like this end use, or we don't like the kinds of people in this class.
Well, that wasn't what I was insinuating. I just, you answered my question.
But let me just elaborate just a little bit. So there's, whenever, if there was a policy decision at whatever time historically.
Before I came.
They may have set this to reflect the model that we are using now and how we are allocating costs across the different schedules. And it has just changed over time.
Over time.
Because you can set a COSA and things will change over time.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that there was some a policy decision on subsidization, because and that's not unusual for the utility industry. Either one way or the other, residential to commercial or commercial and industrial back to residential. And that can be a policy decision or a philosophy that is deployed.
Thank you. I got my answer.
I have a couple questions. First, it would be good to understand a sense of this over time under these categories, if that's possible for me.
Yes.
So we get a feeling for whether we're making progress or not. And then my second question is, have we changed how we look at the cost? Has there been a fundamental shift in our calculation of the revenue service?
I can't speak to the very, very long term. I can say we're using the same basic model that we used last year. So at least, you know, the year over year change has not been due to any methodological change. Before then, unfortunately, I can't really speak to it, but we can certainly look through our files and try to find some historical informations.
So this same topic. Yeah, this same topic has generated a lot of discussion on the ELT, and quite frankly, a lot of questions from myself. And we are going to take a deeper dive into what our model looks like, how we allocate costs, and we plan to, if the board is agreeable, to do a workshop on this in the months ahead, so that we can all take a deeper dive, make sure we understand what the model, how we're using the model, and then really get alignment around philosophy and our approach to how we want to get back to par or whatever we believe is the right, right level.
Are all of these customers being made aware of these changes?
Yeah, it's part of the communication process for the rate adjustment, revenue adjustments.
And are you getting a lot of static card?
This is the first step in that process. We need to get board approval first to move forward with the recommended rate adjustment. And this is a process that we use, public hearing,
yeah,
and then approval. And this is a process that we used last year before. Anytime we do a rate increase, and as Christina had pointed out, these percentages aren't too far off from where they were last year and the year before.
I very much welcome you're looking at in terms of policy change, and given where we are and where we're probably headed.
Yep.
And that was one of my, on the final page, I made a note to that very same thing, and that might be that would be an opportunity where we look more in depth at the question that you had. It's critical,
yep,
from my perspective.
You're
we can't keep going down this path.
Right, exactly.
My last question is we haven't talked about whether we'll use rate stabilization funds to lower the overall interest rates. If we did, say we lower it to 4% or 5%, we have a thought about how we can divvy that out. One more art.
There's always art. You can't get away from the art. Now, if the rate increase was lower, you know, we could discuss moving closer to COSA, you know, maybe keep a 5 for the residential and, you know, a little less for the others, or not. I would turn to one of the finance people to speak to whether a 4% rate increase overall would be a thing.
Yeah, I just throw that number out, Scott.
Yeah, and not to think about it in specific rate category or rate schedules, but if we use the rate stabilization or other reserves, we ultimately have to pay them back. So if we don't increase that rate now, and we don't have a clear trajectory to get our reserves back to where they need to be, then we're just going to tack on that in the future. And that's what we want to do in the next month or so, is take a deeper dive on the strategy around how do we use reserves to help us subsidize with the rate increase and our other tools that we have to make sure we can execute on our work plan and have a trajectory to get to where we need to be from a reserve standpoint.
Yeah, I realize that for our normal reserves, I thought our rate stabilization fund was above and beyond our reserve policy, the fund that was established years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you remember, Commissioner Olson, just for this type of situation.
Yeah. It was one, it's 125 now, and it was 171, and it was reduced.
I don't know the exact amounts, but it'd probably be good to have Scott talk about, because the rate stabilization is part of our overall operating reserves. It's a fund within the operating reserves. But again, I'll let Scott.
Yeah, a quick reserve detour here. So you zoom out for just a second. Two very broad buckets of reserves. One is really about bond reserves, debt requirements, those kinds of things. So park those. We've got a lot of those kinds of accounts that we use for construction funds and everything else. So put those aside. What we're really focusing on here are the operating reserves and the sort of suite of reserves around that, right? And it's really three reserves. And we use varying terminologies here, but let me just use the terminology we use inside the finance group. The traditional operating reserve, regular everyday checking account, is the one we target for 120 days. We focus on it very, very, very sharply. So that's piece one. Piece two is the debt management fund. Now, we've probably called it a variety of things, but it was established, I think, in 2019. Is that right? Smarter people in the back row are nodding their heads. So 2019, we took part of the operating reserve and pulled it out, defined it as a debt management fund. We've talked a little bit about that one. The third one is probably what you're talking about. We call it a contingency reserve. We've also called it a rate stabilization reserve. We've called it a variety of things. That account, that one in particular, has $125 million in it. $10 million of that is an insurance reserve that we need to keep. We'll park that aside. So the remaining $115 million that's in that $125 contingency reserve, those funds are available, and we can tap into them based on certain operational criteria. So we could tap into them if we wanted to. We talked about this last year. We were reluctant to tap into it last year because we wanted to go through that cost management discipline process. We did that in response to last year's challenges. We also did that as we headed into the 2024 budget. We don't really want to go through that process again. We did a lot of belt tightening. And so we're working cost management for now. So really we're left with, what do we want to do with rates? And then what do we want to do with the contingency reserve? Our suggestion right now is, let's hold on to the contingency reserve until later this year. There's no reason in my mind to tap into it just yet. The 5.8 recommendation that we're making does not mathematically solve our problem. It gets a good step in the direction of solving it, but we came out of January with a $40+ million problem. Taking the rate increase from 3.8 to 5.8 gives us maybe $9 or $10 million. So we still have a gap that we're focusing on. What I'd like to do, our recommendation has been to, let's let the year play out a little bit more. Let's see how the rest of the winter goes. Let's see how revenue shakes out. We've actually seen a little bit of an uptick in revenue, so that's good. We're evaluating some movements in capital dollars with bond funding. We're kind of looking at those opportunities as well, so we can help prop up operating reserves. So our suggestion is, let's take this step. It's not a great full step that solves the problem, but it's a good big step. It's not Clark County catastrophic. It's not Seattle City Lights and other places kind of rate increases. It's one that we hope our customers can take and work with us and be patient with us here, this first step. And then later this year, we'd like to come back to you and say, okay, here's how the year played out. If we do need to tap into that contingency reserve, we can do that. John is right on a really important point. That contingency reserve does require us to replenish it over a certain period of time. So if later this year we said, hey, let's pull 20 million out, we need to do a plan to replenish that 20 million unless you all decide you want to change the underlying resolutions and targets and everything else. So that's where we are. We have a presentation that we're planning on coming back to you in 2 weeks, the February 20th meeting. We'll be here in the morning session talking about some of these reserve things in more detail. Some thoughts on what we think we can do today or soon, and then our plan for the rest of the year, which is going to be a refresh on resolutions, looking at the targets for contingency reserve and seeing if we need to use it. So that's my 4 or 5 minute quick outflow on reserves, but that's where we are. We certainly don't recommend using it just yet. I think if we were trying to solve the whole problem today, we'd probably be pushing for a higher rate increase and pulling money out, but I just don't think we're there yet. I don't think we need to do that yet. Was that sufficiently convoluted and confusing?
No, it was very clear. Then I'll have some more questions, Commissioner.
Actually, my question is, I know that the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission governs for-profit utilities. Do they have anything to do with nothing to do with oversight of any of it?
Sole rate making authority rests with this commission.
Right, yeah.
We don't want to live there.
I know, I just you know, my little brain working here.
Reserves was on my mind too, but I what John said and your comments really brought to the forefront for me is you want to be very careful about dipping into that stabilization reserve, because I do think replenishing it. I'm thinking, as I've heard from John this morning, is it's a policy decision. And to use that to me does not seem wise. Because we're looking at things that are we're looking at patterns that aren't going to go away. So we can't keep dipping into those reserves. I don't believe. Earthquake. Maybe we might want to dip in for earthquake.
I agree with you, Commissioner. I think the way I think about it is, it's there to use, right? It is there to use if we need it. We need to be thinking about whether we are in a moment that is, number one, so big and catastrophic and unusual that we can't work our way through it. And are we in a moment where we don't have other tools? And last year, that was really where our head was, is, okay, well, we had a moment, $40 or $50 million moment in January of 23, huge, huge month for us financially, very detrimental financially. But did we have other tools that we could work through? And we did. The organization and leadership of the organization did a tremendous amount of really, really good work to reprioritize our cost management over the course of the spring and summer. And we did the same going into this budget season. So we had those other tools, and I think we did them in a wonderful way, and people stepped up and handled that issue. I think we're in a similar place today, except that the tool is probably less cost management and more, let's just pause and wait and see. We don't want to put too much pressure on our customers by pushing this up to 6 or 8 or 10. And we also don't want to over access reserves yet because we're just not sure how the year is going to play out. We'd like to give it a little bit of time. Maybe in a place in the fall where we say, year shook out okay, and here's all the things that happened, and we're in a position where we can hold on to that. But I'd like to hold that power if we can.
And just two more comments with, here's two things that to me, one is an advantage and the other is just how do we hedge our risk. We have the opportunity, even though, you know, the Martin Luther King weekend, we took a $40 million hit. We have the opportunity to time this rate adjustment and look at this from a more, a little bit longer term and more strategic. So that's a good thing. The other thing though that we have to keep in mind is we've had three of those events in the past 5 years.
Yes.
Winter of 2019, first quarter of last year, and Martin Luther King. My crystal ball says those aren't going away. So we've got to build the financial health of the organization to be able to weather those events much more effectively than we have the last two. And with the BPA contracts, all the things that are going on in the power supply, policy decisions, what we've already touched on, right? The affordability of those decisions, the economics around those decisions, and the reliability. To me, this is one simple step to get us headed on that trajectory that regains our financial health and allows us to weather these types of events in the future more effectively. And in part, when I say weather, meaning how do we build our financial stability to where we can budget to hold more length so we aren't at risk in the same way that we were trying to weather a Martin Luther King holiday.
Can I make one other very quick point and then I'll get out of your hair because I don't want to. We've derailed the rate presentation.
I apologize.
Well, no, it's a great discussion.
Relevant.
We expected this conversation to happen. I do want to reinforce maybe two very quick points. One is when was S&P? S&P took a refresh look in January. Was it January? Standard & Poor, you know, we're rated by the rating agencies, and Standard & Poor took another look at our financial health back in January, just this past month. And just, I want to say this out loud, the PUD still has a very, very strong financial health footprint. And so a lot of the things that we're talking about here, we're in a good position to respond to those and perhaps respond to them better than some other peer utilities in the region because we've got such good financial health. And so it helps us have, you know, a 5.8 as opposed to a 14.5. So I just want to reassure folks that, you know, outside parties are looking at us constantly. They are affirming for us that our financial health is still very, very good. So nothing that we're talking about is impacting that. I will get on a quick 30-second rant with John. The policy stuff is very, very powerful. And Commissioner Wolf made this comment a meeting or two back that the electric industry and the electricity is going to get more and more and more expensive. We're doing everything we can to avoid that, but inching and constraining resource opportunities while simultaneously making policies to push electrification. The intersection of those two things is the most basic economic supply and demand problem the industry's probably ever had. So, especially here in this region and in this state. So, just to add on to John's light rant, my rant's probably louder and more cranky, but it is a huge, huge issue. And we've got to think about these things in that context because this is going to continue to be problem for us for a few years, several years here, and the upward pressure on rates is not going away, in my view.
Okay, Mr. Olson, you have a question?
We're way off the rate presentation. What I'm hearing it does give me comfort, but I've heard from you and from John that what was is not work anymore, and that's what that's what we're looking at. And another thing that maybe wasn't stressed is we cannot continue. Good budget management is wonderful, but you can't continue to slash year after year, push work out year after year. You're going to have a turn a molehill into a mountain. So I'm done.
I don't think so. I think that looking at, I won't name names, but some of the other PUDs that are having greater increases.
Oh, I can name them if
Well, I've seen the chart. And
you'll see a chart here in a minute, actually.
We're kind of in the middle, aren't we? But I think people are going to have to, as I've said before, I think people need to be realizing they need a reality check about how things can be better when we get where we want to go, you know? And I think a big part of our whole big picture here is we're trying to do things to reduce our risk. Like for wildfire, we have a wildfire prevention program that we're working on, and I've just been working on a resolution about that with the NWPPA. And so the whole community of utilities is trying to reduce our risk, because if we have a major, major wildfire, it's going to hit us everywhere. Things like that. I mean, that's just one example.
Scott, for me, my challenge is understanding the rate stabilization fund and the context of it. And when I first came on the commission 7 or 8 years ago, it was always called the rate stabilization fund. And I had been led to believe, maybe erroneously on my part, that it had been money previous commissions had put in there in good years for these kinds of eventualities. The other side of it is, it's hard for me to understand what potential risk are out there to rates, other than the kind we've seen 3 times in the last few years. The $10 million is understandable for the insurance. So I just get some more context in the future.
Yep.
About the fund. Do others have this fund? We have the magnitude that we should have for the size of the utility we are. Just some better context would be helpful for me.
Yeah, so quick comment on that. Agree with all of that. I think we could have 20 different folks come in and evaluate the adequacy of $15 million contingency fund, and we'd have 20 different answers. So we'll have one of many. One of the things that we are taking on, though, is between now, our plan is to come back to you in August and September. We'll talk more about this at the next meeting, but come back in August or September with a suite of things, one of which is a refresh on the resolutions themselves that have stood up our reserves, and that's something we're working with Collins Group on. And then we do want to, on our to-do list, is to reevaluate the adequacy and the need in that contingency fund. So you've mentioned this multiple times, Commissioner Logan. And so we have had that on our to-do list for a while. We haven't gotten around to it. We're taking that on this year too, is to come back and say, in a more artful, more articulate way, to say, here's what we think that fund should be. And if we think it should be $150 million, we'll lay out a plan over the next few years to try to get there. If we think it should be less, which I doubt, we'll talk about it. But that's on our list. I'm going to commit that we'll come back in end of summer, beginning of fall. The timing is important then, because we want to come back then so that we can have a good discussion about where we've landed on reserves, updates to resolutions, targets and reserves, and potential usage of the contingency reserve ahead of the 25 budget season. And so that's kind of our timing. So we'll come back later this month, talk a little bit more about some of these things. I've kind of hit on a lot of the things today. And then we're going to have some homework that we'll come back to in August or September that I hope will whet your appetite.
I will say, Commissioner Logan, not an uncommon discussion. Scott can correct me if I'm wrong, but rate stabilizations are typically heavily connected to bond covenants and associated with your debt service coverage ratio. So the misnomer is not lost on most individuals thinking that a rate stabilization fund is really to ensure that customers don't bear the burden. It's the subsidized rates. We're sure that the rates aren't impacted. But most of those commitments, as we'll see through a later reserve discussion that talks of all the parameters associated with utilizing those funds, is associated with commitments of, in order to pay our debts and obligations for bonds.
And it was called the State Rate Stabilization Fund, and it was linked to the time the utility had to raise customers' rates 36%. So it was after that that slowly that fund built up. And perhaps we shouldn't call it that anymore.
Or do I have any intentions of having that kind of situation?
We'll
have a new CFO after that.
Regarding the financial connections to all of this, the reason I mentioned wildfires, and you talked about the 3B cold weather hits, but I think about some of the huge costs in Oregon and California because of fire, related to fires, and what it's cost them, and I'm just wondering if that's part of Clark's problem. Did they get hit by the wildfire? Okay. Well, anyway, we have to be prepared that we protect ourselves against all of those risks, severe cold, severe heat, and wildfires.
Christina,
what do you think of home? Get us back on track here.
Okay, we'll snap the whip here. All right, so we've done the cost of service. We've come up with a number, and then we've had that policy conversation, and certainly your input is very valuable to move to this, implementing those less quantitative factors like, gradualism and customer acceptance to get to these recommended percents. And now we actually get into how do you translate those into a price per unit, which is your rate design. So so that's how the customer actually interacts with the rate and the price. And again, you take these COSA results. The COSA does have an output of what a theoretically ideal cost per kilowatt hour or cost per month or so on would be. But of course, again, there are those non-quantitative factors like customer understanding or the availability of meter technology that is the art part of making the rate design. So the second most complicated chart here that will probably end in this presentation is this, because we've been on a path with the residential rates where we're currently in this first column here, and we have in the rate ordinance right now a scheduled 2024 rate with higher customer charges, daily charges there based on customers' amperage. So, but this rate was designed sort of to keep the revenues neutral. But of course, the revenues are not neutral. Now we're implementing this 5.8% rate increase for the residential class. So to do that, we've kept in this draft rate design those fixed charges the same, what we promised the customers, and then put that 5.8%, the necessary increase there in the energy charge, so that you see the red will be the change. And to show you some examples of how that will appear to a customer, here is an example of a small bill. So the smallest customer charge, you can see the current, it is what it is. Scheduled, you can see that it's about the increase in the customer charge on the top in the green is canceled out by the decrease in energy charge if we were to be able to keep our current rates, but we can't. So we're adding that yellow bar on the third picture, which is a higher energy charge to get the required percent increase.
If I remember, small is generally apartments.
Yes, generally apartments and ones with very small amperage units. So for a medium customer, same picture, slightly higher magnitudes again with that. And then those are the most of our customers are small or medium. We have a few that are large or extra large customers, but not very many at all. There, so we have some sample bills there. And here is our quote, what that will do for us from a rate stability perspective and a revenue stability perspective, moving from our current rate customer, our rate design to the proposed rate design, we hope will increase the amount that we're recovering from fixed charges about 5 percentage points.
Did you say risk? Risk what charges?
Oh, fixed.
Oh, fixed.
Fixed charges about 5 percentage points, which is in alignment our across the surface, which is just even a bit higher, but again, we're stepping into that slowly. Our other major classes are the general service classes. So the small commercial here is the small general service. And based on what we're seeing from our cost of service, that suggests that class also should be paying some more in the fixed customer charge. So that's where we're putting the rate increase in this plan. And then for the medium service, again, putting it in the customer charge, and this customer class also has a demand charge, which is a charge for peak energy. So again, based on the cost of service results, those suggest that those fixed amounts should be a little bit higher, and then some tiny tweaks for the higher tiers as well. And then lastly, our large primary service, we recommend changing all the elements of its rate. Again, we're slowly getting towards cost of service, thinking about the impacts on the various customers. Any questions about rate design?
Questions, commissioners?
Not for me.
I have none. She explained it very clearly.
You know, just to refresh my memory, are we on our last step in increasing the residential fixed cost?
From the current plan, yes.
Okay.
Now, of course, when we go through the planned COSA review, then we'll probably have a new plan.
Of course, I agree.
But right now, this is the conclusion of the plan. And as I think the commissioners already previewed themselves without me, this is our current standing among our peer utilities and what we know. And of course, 2024 has not occurred yet, so we don't know for certain necessarily what all our peer utilities are planning on doing. But from our best knowledge, we certainly know we're not the only ones that are facing these new regional challenges and resulting in rate increases. So the final part of my presentation is to make you aware of where we are on the timeline and our need from you as a commission in order to get these rates implemented in a timely fashion. I don't know if you remember, but we were actually supposed to come to you 2 weeks ago with these rates. The presentation was all ready to go. I got it into the clerks, and then the long weekend happened, and the best laid plans went quite astray. So this presentation has been delayed, and unfortunately, that's pushed our timeline a little bit tighter than we wish. And in fact, that's one of the things that we're working with as a process improvement for next year, is to try to get some better coordination between the finance department and myself, so we can maybe move this forward so it earlier in the year with the budget. But for this year, because we had these delays, we're hoping to have the public hearing promptly at the next meeting and the board approval in March for rates to be effective in April. But we're having an SAP freeze coming up soon. So if we're already having to start to look at what the changes that would be need to be made in the system, and if we're going to get these rates implemented in April, it'd be really, really nice to know if the commission has any concerns with these rates earlier rather than later. So if we need to do any rate design things, I can do the numbers and get them over to the SAP people so they can be tested and ready to go. If we get a last minute change, that might require us to bump the effective date a little bit in order to have time to do it all in SAP with the SAP freeze that's planning to occur also in the spring. So there, you know, there's the two points, which are the policy points, which is getting comfortable with these rates here is our recommendation. And that step, as we've discussed, for, you know, moving gradualism, the gradualism plan that we've proposed, or if the commission is uncomfortable with that, then again, be good to know now so we can show you some more options. And then the particulars of the rate design with the fixed amounts and the variable amounts, and if everyone's sort of happy with how we've continued moving along the plan and putting it in the variable charges where we have, or the fixed charges where we have. Those are the two issues, because we hope to do it a little bit differently next year, but this year that is where we are on the timeline.
So Commissioner, I think first thing to ask is how we each feel about this, so that surprises towards the end, or we could minimize that. Do you guys have any thoughts, Commissioner Wolf?
I think you've done an amazingly competent job of getting where we, you know, it, all of this figured out, and it makes sense to me. I still have a little bit of studying to do, but I am happy, but pleased with the work that you've done. We're not happy. Objections to having the hearing on the 20th.
Well, the hearing hasn't occurred, and that's the opportunity for customer input that the commission would seek. What I'm hearing, it seems a good path, but I'm not ready for a commitment until. Input from our customers.
Yeah, we're not trying to bypass customer input here. But if you have questions, if you can, you know, and certainly if you're thinking through this in the future, if you just get questions to us, and we'll do our best to turn them around quickly, so you can have that comfort.
Yeah, I don't have any questions. I am looking forward to a future opportunity to workshop or whatever to understand how we're going to diverge. Converge these different classes into something that's more equitable or not.
Yeah, and
that's in our plan.
Excellent. We're certainly not asking for a commitment. We've got the next meeting, the public hearing. Want to have a good, robust discussion then, especially with the presentation that Scott and team are going to bring on that. Reserve funds and other strategy that needs to be incorporated into this. And to Christina's point, we will do this. We will modify the timeline more similar to what we do with water, and have this conversation as part of the budget conversation. So we are in sync on when we go into the year. We have a clear line of sight on what the rate increase would. Or revenue requirement needs to be, and to streamline this process.
I just have one thought about this, and that is the short time between the public hearing and the board approval. I believe I heard you say, John, that that we will not be able to inform all the customers until after it's approved by the board. Did I hear that?
Yeah, we don't actually inform customers until that is approved.
Is it possible for them to be informed that this is what is being proposed?
Yeah, we are already having those conversations.
Okay, because there has to be time for public comment.
Yep.
And that's not a lot of time, though.
Yep.
Okay. We're covered.
Just a final, looking forward to the hearing. And I do agree we worked very hard to be in the middle of the pack in terms of what others are doing. But I'm looking at it as a customer. We know what we're talking about. We know the drivers. But just a few bullet points at the hearing doesn't cut it for me. there needs to be something behind it that is pretty, it is dramatic what we're experiencing, so the customers understand this, the significant swings in the cost and availability of stuff that is used every day to keep the lights on and the market. So this commissioner would like just a little meat on the bones as to what's driving this.
Yeah, and I think that that sort of gets back to the what I talked about this morning, whether there's an op-ed piece in our future about how we got here. I think it's important for our customers to understand just a few months ago, we had budgeted a 3.8% increase based on all we did and all we expected for a solid budget for this year. And now we're looking at a 5.8 because of what, 3 or 4 day of spend in January. I think it's important. It's important for people to understand. It's important for them to understand, you know, what we're doing to help mitigate that now and in the future.
Agreed. Good point.
Any other follow-up?
No, but along with this, you're also talking to Jeff about ways to ease the strain on our lowest income. So at the same time, we're also looking at helping ease the burden for people for whom this would be an increased burden.
Yeah, that's always part of our.
I know. So just a reminder that we're going to be very aware of those customers as well.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you, Christy. Thank you, Peter. And then thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Anything else for us this morning, right?
That's it.
It is now 10:26 a.m. and the meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission room at 1:30 p.m. Thank you.